Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass. And today we are talking education policy with Ashley Rogers Berner. Ashley is a professor of education at Johns Hopkins University and director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. Ashley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I have known Ashley for a few years now. She is a Compass advisor and does, I think, a lot of the best work on education pluralism, which we will talk about exactly what that means. But her new book, which is really, I'd say, the authoritative treatment of the subject, especially in the current U.S. political context, is Educational Pluralism and Democracy, How to Handle Indoctrination, Promote Exposure, and Rebuild America's Schools. So Ashley, let's start here. What is educational pluralism and why isn't it just school choice?
It's a great question. So educational pluralism is just a different way to think of and to enact public education than we're used to in the States. It's essentially a way of structuring public education so that the state or the government funds and regulates, but doesn't necessarily deliver education. So we've become used to, in our country, having the district school equated with public education. And, you know, the district school, the schools are owned, operated, and controlled exclusively by the state. But when we look to other countries, particularly other democracies, we find a very different understanding of public education. We find many, many, many democracies, in fact, around the world, 171 out of 204 countries that UNESCO tracks, have kind of a diverse delivery model of some kind. So in places like the Netherlands, we have 36 different kinds of schools being funded and held accountable for academic results. The same is true in the UK, the same is true in Belgium, Poland, Sweden, Indonesia, Israel, many provinces of Canada. It's quite remarkable how anomalous our system is internationally.
And yeah, this is a theme we touch on in a lot of contexts at American Compass. We see the same thing in the organized labor context. We see the same thing in a host of economic policies. And it's always interesting to me that I think especially conservatives in the U.S. have tended to be suspicious of other models, and in part for the nakedly political reason that they thought, well, you know, European models, that must be socialist or left-wing somehow. And yet, in a lot of cases, that's not true at all. And certainly this is one of them where what you see on the continent, certainly, in a lot of cases, looks a lot more like the kind of school choice that you see conservatives arguing for here. Is that a fair analogy?
Yes and no. I would say the big difference is, and it's certainly in Europe and many provinces of Canada, there is what we would call school choice by design, but there's also academic accountability and quality oversight by design. So that would be the biggest difference that I would make between what's kind of historically plural countries and ours, is that here we find conservatives sometimes arguing for a market approach to school choice of just let parent autonomy drive quality. That's a farther afield from what European pluralist systems do, where, as I said, the Netherlands funds 36 different kinds of schools, but they all have to take the same exit exams. They all have to take, you know, a similar, not identical, but equivalent curriculum. And that is very much the norm around the world. Now, we have countries like, I mean, developing countries are also sometimes province by province adapting more of a kind of voucher model. But again, quality is not jettisoned in the same breath. I think those are both important for pluralism, just theoretically, that on the one hand, education can't be neutral, and so we should fund and support a wide variety of institutions. And on the other hand, education is not like other choices, for want of a better word, that we make. It's not like buying a a pair of jeans or a car. We're all implicated in this. And the purpose of public education is to create educated citizens for the perpetuation of our democracy, among other things.
Yeah, and in a sense, the model it brings to mind is almost sort of like that of a regulated utility, where mm-hmm. we say, you know, we don't like the idea of a single state-run sole supplier necessarily. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of benefits to just having different choices, having different providers, having different models. At the same time, we recognize for a variety of reasons, this isn't a tube of toothpaste, and it's not simply a matter of, although toothpaste is even probably regulated by the FDA more than some would like. But yeah. this isn't just a box on a shelf. This is a sort of a service that is deeply integrated into the society, into the democracy. And so it sounds like, in particular, in terms of curriculum-wise, what is taught in the schools, and then standards-wise, how we measure whether you are effective mm-hmm. or not, there is that oversight and accountability coming from the government at the end of the day.
That's right. The way that a lot of our international peers talk about this is the state is the guarantor, the final guarantor of at best, access and excellence. And there are effective and ineffective ways to go about that. And I'm happy to talk about that. Not all systems are equal. Not all systems are excellent. But there are levers that you can pull to make the good and the equitable both more likely. I think to your point about the analog between educational pluralism and other institutions in the United States, you know, the SNAP program, which provides vouchers for food and for low-income families, the state allows agency. The state allows individuals who receive these funds to make choices about the kind of food they want, but there are limits. You can't buy cigarettes. You can't buy alcohol. You can't buy dog food. You can't buy certain cleaning products with the funds because that's not their purpose. They're there to nourish the next generation. And the same is true of schools. You know, we're missing a piece, I feel, when we consign all quality control to parents.
And why not consign all quality control to parents? I mean, I think I can think of a few reasons, but it's interesting to think about where the school choice movement's sort of motivation or focus tends to come from. Mm-hmm. One piece is on kind of academic quality and excellence and the belief that if you have more competition, if you have more choice, you will get better outcomes. Mm-hmm. One piece is the sort of pluralism for pluralism's sake, that mm-hmm. choice is sort of inherently good and mm-hmm. people should be allowed to sort of choose whatever they want. What is the argument for the government as better guarantor than the parent of who is and is not offering an effective mm-hmm. education?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think parents are an important part of the equation. And when you look at the political philosophy behind all this, you have to think about what's the maximum best interaction between the family, the state, and the organs of civil society. And there, I think, if you want to think about this as like a scale, there's a risk in having all power rest in the hands of the state because education is inherently values driven. And why should the state determine all the values? There's something oppressive about that. We certainly have ample examples from human history of the state of everything being seconded to the state. On the other hand, and this is very familiar to those who read Alexis de Tocqueville, right? That there's a risk within a democratic society of the atomization of individuals and the autonomous individual as, you know, pursuing one's own ends and even one's family's own ends. And so I think pluralism tries to go right squarely in the middle and say education should be responsive to parents and their needs and their children's differences from one another, even in the same family. And at the same time, because this is a collective endeavor, It isn't about simply individual pursuits. It is and it isn't. But unlike buying a car, for example, it matters to me that your child knows how to read. It should matter to you that my children know the branches of government and history and all of these things. So we're all implicated. And I think more specifically, if you ask the question, why is choice necessary but insufficient? Why is parent autonomy insufficient? There are a couple things. First of all, social networks matter. And all the studies of parents and parent behavior suggest that families make decisions about schools based on the information that they have. And so very well-resourced families who can get consultants and spend a lot of time on the internet researching schools are going to navigate the system more successfully. The vast majority of parents want a navigator to help determine quality. So when you consider the fact that in many of our urban centers, 40% of the adults are functionally illiterate, that's a huge differential. So the one thing is simply not about controlling parents, but about giving parents information, making sure that the information is accurate. It is very hard to do something that sounds simple, like design a curriculum. It's really hard. You know, it's I've done this for a long time. My institute works on high quality curriculum. And, you know, I've been in that space for a long time, but I still wouldn't be confident in my ability to match my kids' needs. My children are growing now, but, you know, it with exactly, you know, what they needed over the long course of their K to 12 journey. I mean, I'd do a good job, but it wouldn't be perfect. And I'm well educated and have been, you know, blessed with a great education. So it's the social network, it's the equalizing of parent opportunity. But number two, it's also because we get attracted and attached, I should say, we get attached to things that don't necessarily serve us well. Schools are communities. It is very hard to pick up and leave a school once you've been embedded in it. And so from the standpoint, and this is true no matter what kind of school it is, when there's a district school that has to close for good reasons, when there's a charter school or a private school that closes for, even if it's for good reason, fiscal malfeasance or academic underachievement, whatever it is, there's still a grieving process. There's still a grieving process for families, and it's very hard to make those decisions. So I'm with my colleague, Charlie Glenn, who really is a giant in this field. And I'll never forget what he said in one of his pieces of writing on equity. Quote, "It is an appropriate goal of public policy to make sure there are no failing schools." So keep people who are low performing, keep bad actors out on the front end and have the mechanism to regroup and close if you need to. You know, all the surveys of parents show they want more choices, but they want high quality choices. Yeah, so I think.
That makes sense. And mm-hmm. I think it also resonates with a lot of, you know, debates going on within the right of center in particular, where you mm-hmm. used to have this more kind of radical, almost fetishization of choice as the end all be all and the key to everything good in the world. And I think as folks are recognizing, you know, markets have limits in all sorts of ways, but also that, you know, there are many things that you care that need considerations besides choice. And obviously the education of a generation of citizens is maybe first among those.
Yes.
But I also think of it in the context of, I think we're seeing this a lot in healthcare mm-hmm. at this point, where people are saying, you know, giving me maximum shopping control over something like health insurance or how to treat my cancer isn't necessarily what the typical citizen is looking for or can optimize with. And I guess I'm always struck by, my new favorite example is Silicon Valley Bank, which is, you know, the mm-hmm. the bank where you had all of these startups just took literally hundreds of millions of dollars, left it in cash in accounts in an insolvent mm-hmm. bank. And there you had, you know, what should have been maybe the most sophisticated actors dealing with the kind of most important financial decisions, hundreds of millions of dollars on the line. And even then, the very basic choice of like, where should we put our money was not something that they were in any position to handle effectively without aggressive government oversight and regulation. And so the point that, you know, I think, as you said, there are plenty of families out there that might do just fine with total choice and make great choices. But there are also an awful lot who benefit from and potentially need need more than that.
Well, and let me just flip this to the positive side. If you think about where the research goes, and if you were to say, looking at international research, what are the steps you can take, any school, any system, to make sure that kids are learning maximally, that you're closing the achievement gaps between wealthy and poor kids, the things that we want, excellence and equal access to excellence. One of the biggest ticket items you can do is to insist on a liberal arts curriculum or a robust academic program that all kids have access to. That's a game changer. And so if we just allow choice between middling and low performing curricula and models, we're not going to make headway against those tragic achievement gaps that have characterized our country for far too long. If you want to see systems that are closing achievement gaps and helping all kids succeed, they're putting in place rigorous curriculum. For those who are outside of education policy, it is our achievement gaps and our underachievement more generally are profound. It's hard to have the arguments at the high level of policy without thinking about such facts as 12% of high school seniors are deemed proficient in U.S. history, 12%. Now, most of our elementary schools, in the aggregate, only 30% of kids are proficient in English language arts. A third, really proficient? I mean, and grade inflation is endemic, and you know, graduation rates are deceptive. You can easily make it easier to graduate. So there are there's real problems in our system that have to do with a lack of academic rigor. And I actually spend a whole chapter in this new book talking about why we don't have a rigorous curriculum and what the consequences are. So that's another reason I feel very strongly that we can't just say, oh, let's let parents choose their own adventure. Well, it matters what you choose. And if we really want to make headway on equal opportunity and excellent citizenship, we are leaving a huge lever off the table if that's all we do.
Yeah. So I want to get into the sort of politics of this and the paths to actually pursuing reform, but just to make very concrete, okay, what would this system look like in practice? Step one is it seems like, so from a funding perspective, it starts to look more like a voucher model or a funding students, not systems model. You need to figure out where the money is coming from and what the amount is. But at the end of the day, there's some amount of money attached to each student. And it is up to the family to then decide where the student attends, and where the student attends, so goes the money.
Right.
From the student's perspective, from the provider perspective, as you've been emphasizing, that doesn't mean I can just put up a sign outside my house and sign kids up and cash the checks. It also means I have to teach a certain curriculum that's going to be defined, whether it's at the local or state or federal, whoever we decide is going to be defining what has to be taught, and then I'm going to be accountable for the students at my school taking the same tests everybody else tests and performing well on them. Is that, I guess, two questions that come to mind related to that. One, what happens to homeschooling? And two, what happens if I'm doing a bad job?
So a couple things on this. First, I have to qualify what I mean by kind of a common content. In the United States, for more than 100 years, We have focused our teaching profession, our schools have focused, with some exceptions, but we've focused on the process of learning, the skills of learning, as opposed to learning something in particular. And this was a very intentional decision made at the elite level of schools of education in the early 20th century that, you know, the argument was, look, most countries democratize the liberal arts when they expand access to education. We used to, but it's time for us to put aside the democratizing the liberal arts. We're not going to teach Latin. We're not going to require algebra. We're not going to require certain bodies of literature. We're going to pivot towards skills of expressivism, helping each child follow their interests. I mean, this, anything but the academic curriculum is really, as Diane Ravitch says, this is the real story of 20th century education, the leeching away of content. So when we have in our country now, we have standards-based assessments. In math, standards and content are very similar. In English and in history, the social sciences, they are profoundly different. And so the way that we test, I think, needs to be changed. And here, I would look at the pluralistic systems that have meaningful content exit exams. So your child, so let me give a couple of examples. So most of the nations of Europe do fund all different kinds of schools, but they also require comparative religion and ethics every year. So you may be going to a Jewish day school, but you're going to learn what Catholics believe, what Marxists believe, and so forth, as part of being an educated person. And you're going to have an exit exam at some point. Well, actually, I should qualify that. Not every country tests comparative religion and ethics as a tested subject, but they all have to teach it in Europe. Or in science, the Netherlands funds creationist schools, but every child in a creationist school has to demonstrate competent knowledge of evolutionary theory. So they separate the structure, the ethos of the school from the content. So when I talk about a common kind of common content, I'm not saying the same textbook, the same exact curriculum, but big domains of knowledge, yes.
Yeah.
We're well, a long I mean, way from that, but that, yeah, I guess.
Think, let me to put a fine point on it, because I think it's, you know, anyone who's had kids go through public schools at this point, well, will know exactly what you're describing. I think for folks who are younger or have already chosen to enroll their kids in classical schools and so forth, mm-hmm. and haven't seen as much of this, mm-hmm. I think maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me the quintessential illustration of this is that when you're taking a standardized test in social studies, humanities-related mm-hmm. content, they purport to be essentially measuring, have you learned, quote, how to learn?
Exactly.
And so the test is you're given a passage to read and then answer questions about the passage. But what the passage says is literally irrelevant. It could be a fantasy story about Martians growing corn on Mars.
It could be the back of a cereal box. It could be an advertisement for a dishwasher.
And as long as you can demonstrate that you read and comprehend what is put in front of your face and answer questions about it, that is what's being assessed and what you're being measured for proficiency on.
You're exactly right, but here's the problem. Kids who have more background knowledge do better on those purportedly content agnostic tests, because it turns out that the more you know about the world, the more, I mean, this is Dan Willingham's work, it's E.D. Hirsch's work, but knowledge sticks to knowledge, as Dan Willingham at UVA says. And so if a child has experienced knowledge-building curriculum where you have to memorize the capitals, say, of the United States, you know, states, or you have to really know what the Roman Empire was all about, or know what, you know, Chinese medicine contributed, things like that, real buckets of knowledge, you are going to do better on comprehension tests. And you know, the tragedy is that so much ELA curriculum, English language arts and social studies curriculum, is designed with this in mind, that it's just, it doesn't matter what you're reading as long as you know how to, quote, find the main idea. that is leaving so much knowledge building off the table. And that the systems that my team has worked with that have gone all in on really rich knowledge building curriculum have seen all those good things happen that we're talking about. And so when you see the difference between a skills-based curriculum and a knowledge-based curriculum, it drives home again and again why we don't want to just cast caution to the wind. We need to lean into this. It's very serious, exciting research. And other countries, you know, I can give you many examples internationally of how this plays out in different ways.
Yeah. Well, and I think you see in the U.S., in those reform-minded schools that are driven most to effectively address our deficiencies, whether that is the urban charter schools or the classical schools, they all recognize exactly this. It is always built first and foremost around the rigorous curriculum and the habits of mind of learning something in particular.
That's right.
And it happens that when you do that, you get pretty good at finding the main argument in the paragraph also.
That's right.
The problem is that the converse is not true. If all you do is drill kids on how to find the main argument in a paragraph, they're not necessarily going to come out, to your point, having the background knowledge, the context, or any sense of what to do once you've found the main argument.
Being able to connect the dots. You know, a great example of this is I did some professional development with a large district's social studies instructors and leaders. They were looking at the Declaration of Human Rights, which was signed in 1948. It was, you know, but the standards approach to this, which they were familiar with, was here's this, in my opinion, very rich document. What does this vocabulary word mean? What does this vocabulary word mean? Find the connection between point A and point B. Instead of saying, wait a minute, this document, who was arguing against human rights? Why was it necessary to have this document? When it just happened? You know, what are the ironies of the U.S. being a signatory when we have racial segregation in our country? You know, all kinds of rich human questions. And that iterative Socratic dialogue is part of the joy of learning that you miss if you're not in classrooms with rigorous conversation. So there, you know, you I don't want to forget what you asked about homeschooling. I think the same is true for homeschooling. Not all homeschooling curricula are equal. And many, many parents are finding their way to high quality materials, but others are not. And
how does an effective pluralist system handle homeschooling that?
I mean, homeschooling is legal in most countries I've studied except Germany. And I would say the best way to handle it is simply to say, let me just back up. In our world today, the states could do a great job by hosting independent reviews of commonly used curricula and saying, homeschooling families, we're glad you're homeschooling. These are the best curricula. Here are the strengths of this one, the weaknesses of this one. My institute has done some of this, but you know, this is something that states do on a routine basis. They could do this for homeschooling curricula. The biggest thing, which is not plausible right now in many contexts, would be to have an exit exam and to say, everybody in our state is going to have to read two Shakespeare plays in 10th grade. I'm just making this up. It could be anything. And you could pick whichever ones you want, or we're going to have a section in our exit exam on 19th century American literature. You can read anything from 19th century American literature. You should read many different authors, different diverse voices, but we're going to ask you essay questions about that domain of knowledge. So this is very much like using what you've read this year. How would you answer this question? That's the way really effective exit exams can be structured. The only state that's really trying this right now is Louisiana, because they have made a big bet on curriculum statewide. They have a lot of their teachers. There are only a few curricula in English language arts that are used at scale in Louisiana. And so they have a state assessment. It's a pilot right now, a state assessment that actually speaks to the curriculum, that actually asks kids to answer questions based on what they've read. It's not just a skills-based test. And it's really, really interesting. We should see more of those. So in Alberta, Canada, for example, they fund all different kinds of schools, Inuit schools, you know, First Nation schools, Jewish, Catholic, non-sectarian. They even fund homeschoolers. But the homeschoolers are supposed to take the exit exams too.
Yep.
So you can get to this. I guess let me just rephrase this. You can get to the information through different lenses.
Right.
You can teach this stuff and say, we don't agree with it. Or we don't think that theory is right, but you still need to teach that theory to your kids.
Yeah. And so in that system, does the family get to keep the money itself as well? Do these systems fund homeschooling the same way they'd fund sending your kid to school?
Each system is different. Alberta, the last I checked, it may have changed. They had a 15% of the per child stipend that goes to homeschoolers. But they have the free curriculum that the province has designed. So, you know, the costs of a curriculum and so forth are not there.
Interesting. All right. Mm-hmm. So on to the politics of all this.
Yeah.
You know, this is obviously anything education related is highly contentious.
Yeah.
Education today is even more contentious. We've seen a number of states shifting toward more of a school choice model mm-hmm. with varying levels of accountability mm-hmm. associated with it. My suspicion is that generally speaking, if you presented this sort of package to conservatives and said, we do need more commitment on the common curriculum and accountability side, but it's going to come with this sort of choice and flexibility, most would say, deal, where do I sign? that's probably less true among progressives, but I'm curious what you've seen as you do this work. Where are the friction mm-hmm. points? Who objects and why?
Mm-hmm. So you're quite right about the conservative side. You know, there is a libertarian wing of the conservative movement that doesn't want, you know, any kind of government regulation except for basic safety. But they're in a minority. I think the vast majority of conservatives would, as you said, take that both and approach. On the left, it's very interesting that the left in our country certainly is the majority of the Democratic Party, say, are very committed to the district school only model. There's a not insignificant portion of Democrats who have always been in favor of charter schools, and or especially during the Obama years, the Democrats for Education Reform was very much anti-union, very much pro-charter schools. And that was very much part of the Obama White House. And Bill Clinton as well was very pro-charter. I think that, well, first, let me just say, I'm about to publish a piece called The Progressive Case for Educational Pluralism. And the really interesting thing is that starting in the 70s in our country, there were civil rights advocates who were very much in favor of the both and of pluralism, of giving families autonomy and agency. And it's an interesting, the arguments are interesting. And they're multifaceted. So I would love to talk to you more about that if you're interested. But there's been a progressive side to this movement since the very beginning. In fact, some would say progressives, you know, really helped get the school choice off the ground, both in practice, when you look at what happened in Milwaukee, and Howard Fuller, who was the superintendent of Milwaukee, was the founder of vouchers, and he is still a civil rights advocate. For all kinds of reasons about being culturally affirming for African-American kids, Latino kids. But as far as is right here and right now, I do think my hope is that when progressives learn to pull back from our current binary of public schools versus private schools and learn that most countries don't have this zero-sum game approach, that it will provide some air in the room. There are always going to be interests on either side who will not bend. But I think there's something really refreshing, disarming, and hospitable about being able to say, we're going to put our weapons down. We're not going to diminish district schools. We're not going to diminish charter schools. We're not going to diminish private schools. There's room for all of us. And actually creating those conversations.
Well, and it occurs to me, this is where the, from the subtitle of your book, the How to Handle Indoctrination point is so important, because it seems to me that that's a lot of where the heightened focus in the system is today. And one thing that I've at least noticed is that up until the last few years, policymakers have basically been operating against this backdrop assumption that a progressive set of norms would more or less shape all of these district schools. And it seems to me that if we suddenly, that in that context, one might assume, might understand why the commitment to the district school would be so strong. But that in a context where you have at least a substantial share of the country saying, well, no, if we have to choose a sort of more explicitly political bent one way or another in our schools, it's going to be one that progressives get very angry and throw book banning tantrums about and so forth. Then the pluralism becomes more attractive. Is that the direction we're headed, or how have you seen that playing out?
I mean, I think that's maybe, I would look at it differently. I would say that we're attached to the district school because it's all we've known. And we're afraid that if we let go of district school only, that we're somehow forsaking public education. If we could just say, wait, that frame is very particular to us. Let's pull back from the frame and reframe the conversation and look at what other countries do. That's one way to kind of go forward. But I do want to point out that the district school has never been neutral with respect to values. It was created at the end of, after the Civil War, to tamp down Catholics who were getting funding for Catholic schools, and in some cities like Boston were becoming a majority. The white Anglo-Saxon Protestants objected to Catholicism, did not feel that Catholicism at scale, if supported by schools, could yield democratic citizens. And so legislature after legislature defunded, quote, sectarian schools, which was code word for Catholic, funded uniform schools. In fact, many of our constitutions have the term unitary or uniform school system. The same legislatures Protestantized the district schools. They required the Protestant Bible, Protestant prayers, and so forth. So district schools were created during the period when the WASP ascendancy was the cultural majority. So, you know, if you were Catholic, Jewish, atheist, Jehovah's Witness at the turn of the last century, you knew you were not in a values neutral school. And that's why, you know, some of the lawsuits started happening, and the Supreme Court, in my view, appropriately secularized the district schools, which Protestant evangelicals experienced as a profound loss. But the real loss was their forebears, right? Making sure that there was only one kind of school funded. If you have only one kind of school funded, it is inherently going to be an ideological battle for control of the messaging of that school. So, you know, if you bear all that in mind, the ideological nature of different schools, you know, A, it's nothing new, and B, it's a really good reason to diversify the types of institutions that are funded.
And so what is the answer to the question, how to handle indoctrination, Ben? Is it that
yes,
everyone, you indoctrinate however you want, but everyone gets to choose which kind?
I would say that schooling is inherently indoctrinatory of sort, in the best sense of the word. This is not nefarious. When you select a curriculum, when you hire staff, when you have disciplinary codes, you are acting on some kind of normative values, even if they're explicit or implicit. And so the first principle of handling indoctrination is realizing there's no way around it. In fact, back to the progressive point, one of the primary objections to the district schools that progressive legal theorists had was that in the 60s and 70s, in their search for neutrality, values neutrality, the district schools were really enforcing a sort of banal non-commitment, which is a stance. It's a position. And it was seen as not adequate to the task of forming citizens. So the first thing about indoctrination is just accept that human institutions are values driven. There's no way around it. So be honest about it. Be upfront about your values and fund diverse values. At the same time, this is a real problem in our country that parents confuse exposure with indoctrination. And this is where the liberal arts curriculum is so important. The liberal arts curriculum inherently involves exposure to ideas that we disagree with. And many parents in many schools view exposure as somehow inherently harmful to kids that we disagree. In this school, even if it's through a lens that you agree with, you know, this is important. This is part of being an educated citizen, is knowing how different people believe and why. So I think it's a tough struggle. It's a tough sell. But I'm hoping that that grand bargain of unique, distinctive schools of whatever variety and a common conversation will ultimately be kind of a selling point where we can settle.
Yeah, it certainly at least has the potential to turn the temperature down in a sense and allow people, create room to disagree, and in some sense, I would imagine, create more comfort with encountering ideas you disagree with if in a sense you're allowed to do it on your home turf.
Exactly. Well, let's just take an example that I use in my book. Suppose, imagine just for the sake of argument, that you know, you've got a school that is founded on critical race theory, that is a belief that race is the primary causal factor in American education or American society writ large and our constitutions and so forth. I mean, theoretically, in a pluralistic system, parents should be able to form that kind of school and send their kids to it, right? In the same way that a Catholic family could do the catechesis from kindergarten on. But all those schools have to learn about, you know, other historical interpretations, other ways of being in the world, you know, all of those things. And that's worth fighting for, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's conclude on the policy side. If one found this vision attractive, what is the constructive next step? What would you like to see policymakers focused on doing, either just wholesale, let's start doing more of this, or investments that need to be made in laying the groundwork for it?
I think at the state level, the two big things. Number one would be to put a big emphasis on curriculum. And you know, some states are already there. The Council for Chief State School Officers, 13 states, are trying to make it easier to adopt high-quality curriculum. So expanding those kinds of curriculum that are reviewed, show parents and schools of all types what's at stake in a given curriculum. And then number two, start tying assessments to the meaningful bodies of knowledge. That's the second one. The third one, of course, would be expanding access and funding for different kinds of schools. So the both and you know, of more families have more choices. All schools are going to be better quality and a common assessment of some kind. Those are the three things I would say.
And anything at the federal level, or do you think really all at the state level at this point?
I mean, I think the state, this is the way our constitutions are constructed. I think it's the state is the real, you know, the state judgment is what drives so much of education policy. 80% of the funding is at the state level. The feds could play a role by, they have certainly in the charter school movement of funding charter schools and could certainly continue to do that. One thing I would love to see is more states using their, drawing on their federal title funds for curriculum, for teacher professional development, for a strong school culture. So those funding streams exist. Most of the time, what is the funding being used for? It's meant to go to low-income kids. Is it going to high-quality curriculum? Is it going to teacher support on the high-quality curriculum? Those are the things that states can do right here and right now with the resources they have.
Yeah. And I guess last question that touches on an American Compass favorite is the vocational education mm-hmm. side of things, mm-hmm. which is also obviously much more prevalent outside of the U.S. In some respects, it seems like, well, this all fits very naturally together. You can have more different kinds of schools, more different mm-hmm. areas of focus. On the other hand, it seems like really doubling down on a focus on rigorous curriculum and knowledge and mm-hmm. accountability for that conflicts with saying, well, not everybody's going to college. Some people, what they really need to learn is a very different set of stuff. How does that get reconciled in systems that do it well?
Systems that do it well have a rigorous curriculum for everybody up until, say, eighth grade. And then in sometime in secondary school, kids do differentiate by their interests, their vocation. Places like Switzerland, almost 70% of students go to vocational training, but it's high performing. I think the difference is that it rests on a high level of academic opportunity so that kids are able to meaningfully say, hey, I don't want to go to the university. I don't need to do that. I'm really interested in engineering and I'm going to go to it's premised on equal access to excellence from the very beginning. And when you look at what many of these leaders have said, it's even more important for kids who don't go to college to be exposed to all these domains of knowledge, not only so that they can choose their own path without any doors having been closed on them by default, but also so that they can engage in the democratic conversation. And that's what the best systems do.
Well, I can't think of any better place to leave it than right there. Ashley Rogers-Berner, thank you so much for making the time today. Your new book is Educational Pluralism and Democracy, How to Handle Indoctrination, Promote Exposure, and Rebuild America's Schools. And hopefully our listeners will all be picking up a copy soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to see you. Thanks for all your work.
Really appreciate your time. This has been another episode of the American Compass podcast. I still don't have a great way of signing off from these, but I'm working on it, and we will be back again soon.